Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Financial Investment Services, LLP, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Richard Martin, and you are listening to the Wake Up Call coming to you all the way from Singapore, and it is Friday, January the 9th, 2015. Well, many of you will have noticed that the dollar is rising vertiginously against all other currencies, which I had expected for some time and warned you about, especially the many of you who had asked which currency they should hold their funds in. Of course, needless to say, the pundits have been heavily bearish on the dollar, confusing, as they do, the American economy with the fortunes of the American currency. So I thought today I'd give you some fairly detailed information on exactly why the dollar is rising and why it can be expected to continue to do so for the foreseeable future. It all has to do with the way in which the citizenry is manipulated into ceding wealth to the privileged few. Taxation does the job nicely, and in fact, throughout most of human history, people have lived under the rule of taxing authorities. The way a taxation system works is easy to understand. Businesses and individuals pay taxes to the state, and the state spends that tax money on armies, road construction, police, courts and jails, education, propaganda, lavish styles for the top dogs, etc. But what if you live under a regime of people who obtain their wealth not through taxation, but through money printing? The money printers will not tell you that they are in power over you. Money printers always go to considerable lengths to disguise their money printing. The money they print in today's world doesn't just roll off government printing presses. It is loaned into existence by a central bank or other banks, which makes the whole process of money creation much more difficult for citizens to understand. So without them telling you that they rule over you, how can you know? To have a firm understanding of the power of the national currency, it's necessary to see how the process of printing money differs, in essence, from taxation. A taxation regime prospers when its tax haul increases. Thus, an intelligently managed taxation-funded regime will take actions to promote the general welfare, as the U.S. Constitution calls it. Such a regime wants businesses and individuals to prosper so that it can obtain a larger tax haul from them. Thus, the interests of the people and of the taxation regime are aligned. They become partners, so to speak, in desiring increased prosperity, and they all share in that increased prosperity if it comes. In a well-managed taxation regime, the state motivates entrepreneurs and workers by allowing them to keep a large share of their earnings. Taxation regimes make management mistakes all the time, setting taxes too high or allowing corruption to seep into their administrations. But under an honest and intelligent taxation regime, the state and the people can work together to achieve success. Taxation regimes sometimes seek to add to their tax hauls by enlarging their borders. This is often done through warfare. Taxation regimes can go bad in a variety of ways. But when the U.S. founders wrote the Constitution, they were trying to set up a decent, durable taxation regime, and the federal government they created did manage to operate successfully for a number of years. If, however, a nation's elites get their wealth and power through money printing, they have a very different path to success. Their success is measured in terms of the total wealth they can take for themselves by printing money and distributing it to themselves and their friends. They maximize their wealth haul in this way, firstly by seeking to enlarge the circulation area of their fiat. A small country, such as Venezuela, cannot print too much fiat without setting off destructive double-digit inflation or disastrous triple-digit hyperinflation. A large country with a large fiat circulation area extending beyond its geographic borders can print much more without creating damaging inflation. Thus, a money printing regime will not seek so much to expand its borders as to expand the circulation area of its unbacked currency, or fiat, as it's called, such as by making agreements with oil-producing states in the Middle East to price their oil in dollars. Requiring that the dollar be used for bank reserves is another way to expand its circulation. A taxation regime, by contrast, that uses a gold-backed currency will not generally seek to expand its currency's circulation zone beyond its borders. The value of a fiat currency, like the value of anything else, is determined by the opposing forces of supply and demand. In a money printing regime, the money printers will keep printing in order to enrich themselves, which of course increases the supply of the fiat and reduces its value. But if at the same time the money printers take actions to increase the demand for their fiat can hold its value even as they furiously print. One way to increase the demand is to enlarge the circulation zone. But there are also several other ways to prop up demand for a fiat currency. They will intend to oppose high taxes. Taxes increase the demand for fiat, as taxpayers must have fiat in order to pay their tax assessments. The optimal rate of taxation in order to spur maximum fiat demand is higher than the Laffer curve, optimum, needed for a maximum tax haul. A money printing regime is thus also a high taxing regime. They will create high levels of debt. This is done for two reasons. One is that under the debt money system that is used in the world today, the act of creating debt and printing money is one and the same. In order to print and take advantage of wealth created by that money printing, debt must necessarily be created at the same time. The other is that debt creates demand for fiat, as debtors must have fiat in order to make their interest payments. Any kind of debt payable in the regime's fiat, whether public or private, adds to the demand for that fiat currency. They will try to enlarge the marketplace of goods and services for sale cheap in exchange for the fiat. This adds to the demand. If I am holding Venezuelan bolivars, the range of goods and services that I can buy in exchange for them is relatively limited. If I have US dollars, however, I can buy millions of different things. This adds hugely to the value of the dollar. Those who hold bolivars will often want to exchange them for dollars if, for example, they want to buy something from Amazon. The money printers like it when other states peg their fiat to the fiat. This has the effect of enlarging the circulation zone. When China pegs its yuan to the dollar, it also helps create a huge marketplace of cheap goods. Fiat demand is thus boosted in two ways, by pegging China's currency to the dollar. They intervene in currency exchange markets to prop up the value of the fiat. This is the direct approach to increasing the demand for a fiat. Go into the market and buy it. This demand is artificial, but is very effective in increasing the value of the fiat. It should be noted that taxation regimes often seek to decrease the value of their fiat in order to spur exports of manufactured items, which will in turn increase employment and spur increased tax revenues. A money printing regime, by contrast, will seek to prop up the value of its fiat, not caring about its nation's manufacturers. Periodically in human history, there have been sad episodes where rulers have attempted to set prices by decree in order to maintain the value of their debased currencies. Such price suppression attempts have always ended in failure, often accompanied by political chaos and bloodshed. Modern techniques of price suppression, however, have replaced these primitive methods of suppressing prices, which were attempted in the U.S. as recently as 1973 under the label of wage and price controls. Price suppression is an unmistakable characteristic of a money printing regime. They suppress wages in order to maximize wealth obtained from money printing. It is not only necessary to print a lot of fiat each year, it is also necessary that the wealth obtained from that money printing be restricted to a select few. When a worker gets a pay increase because of inflation, that worker is getting a piece of the wealth that is not going to the money printers. The money printers maximize their wealth when all the freshly printed fiat goes to them and the workers' incomes as measured in the fiat actually decline. In order to suppress wages, money printers advocate maximum female participation in the workplace, open borders immigration, and global labor arbitrage. Taxation regimes seek to increase taxpayers' wages. Pre-1971, the federal government supported private sector labor unions. Afterwards, it opposed them in surreptitious ways, and today, private sector labor unions have almost ceased to exist. They suppress commodity speculation. In bygone days, debased currency regimes would punish hoarders and speculators by hanging them or shooting them and confiscating their hoards. Today, hoarders and speculators are punished by increased money printer activity in commodity exchanges. Here again, the money printers want all the wealth from money printing to come to them. They see no reason to share it with hoarders and speculators. They promote free trade. It sounds like a good thing to promote free trade, but it's not because they believe in freedom that they promote free trade. They do it to suppress prices. A Navy admiral was recently heard saying that the purpose of the U.S. Navy was, quote-unquote, to protect free trade. I thought the Navy's purpose was to protect the United States, but the money printers have other uses for it. A feature of a money-printing regime is that it makes some of its beneficiaries enormously, obscenely rich, much more so than in a taxation regime. Some of this surplus cash can be used to impose control over the elected government, either by bribery or blackmail, when the money printers control the apparatus of the surveillance state. The banks control the government. As Illinois Senator Durbin admitted in 2009, quote, the banks, hard to believe in a time when we're facing a banking crisis that many of the banks created, are still the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill. And they frankly own the place. End of quote. In a taxation regime, the banks are one powerful interest group among many. In a money printing regime belonging to a debt money system, the banks rule supreme. If your government is behaving like a money printing regime, there's probably not much you can do about it. The money printers have an infinite supply of fiat that they can use at any time to maintain their grip on power. A successful attack on them, if it is to come, will likely come from outside, from rival states who are jealous of rival money printers. In the meantime, the US dollar can be expected to rise as a consequence of all these factors. One thing is clear to me. There can be no meaningful reform in the United States until the money printers are removed from power. As long as their regime is in control, they can only be expected to continue to strip citizens of their wealth through the various means I've just described. It was a sad day in the 1970s when the U.S. came under the rule of the money printers, and it's been a sad era ever since. Unfortunately, there is no knowing when it might end. Okay, well, as always, please do call in, write in to the show, or call me direct if you have any questions or need any advice. Service with a smile, as they say. So, here's my information. The toll-free number is, as always, 888-874-4888. Again, that's 888-874-4888. And if you would rather send me an email, please don't hesitate. Do so, because my email is open at all times, so I should get it very, very quickly. And if you write, please, to rm@gfawd.com. That's once again RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once again, RM@GFAWD.com. And finally, my private number, my direct line, if you would like to call me in private to discuss your questions of economics and financial conundrum, please feel free. Do so by calling me at a number in Sarasota, Florida, area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's area code 941-441-1682. Well, the price of oil continues to crash relentlessly. WTI trades at $47.72 as I'm speaking. That's down 53% since June 2014. The oil price plunge is eating into the American oil boom, creating havoc with income statements and balance sheets of drillers that have gorged on junk debt. It's chewing up junk bonds and leveraged loans. It's frying oil and gas stocks. It's starting to wreak chaos among suppliers to the industry. Layoffs are starting to cascade across the oil patch, company by company, as capital expenditures and operating expenses get slashed in an effort to stay liquid long enough to make it through the oil bust. Oil busts are terrible creatures in oil and gas states such as Texas, Oklahoma, or North Dakota. The last one persisted for a long time. It took down banks, housing, restaurants, oil-filled equipment manufacturers and their suppliers, grocery stores, pickup truck sales plummeted, boat sales dried up, jewelry stores fell on hard times. This time, yes, it is different. Fracking is immensely capital intensive. Wall Street is up to its ears in it. Hedge funds and private equity firms will join banks in taking the hits on their equity stakes and on the debt they hold. But forget that. What we're inundated with is the tsunami of benefits of lower oil prices. Airlines make extra billions by offering the same crummy service without lowering airfares through their fuel costs dropping. Utilities come out ahead for the similar reasons. Toll road operators will be able to raise tolls and extract more money from drivers who are sitting on what they've saved at the pump, according to Wells Fargo. It expects airports to shine. Specifically, large international gateway airports with significant cargo operations. Because consumers will buy more imported stuff with money they saved on gasoline. Alas, much of that gasoline is an entirely American-made product all along the chain, from the technology required to extract crude to the gallon of regular dispensed by a machine. Whatever money consumers save on gas lowers the consumer spending component of GDP. If consumers spend all this money on something else, consumer spending stays flat. It just gets shifted around. But many people won't spend the money on other things. I'm sorry, but this equation doesn't compute. And it's already starting to show up in the corporate numbers. Based on exuberant consumers, overjoyed by what they saved on gas, the consumer discretionary sector of the S&P 500 should be regaling investors with positive revenue and EPS guidance for the fourth quarter. But the opposite is happening. Of the consumer discretionary companies in the S&P 500 that have issued any guidance for the fourth quarter, 24 have issued negative earnings per share guidance, according to FactSet. 89%. That's the worst in the data series going back to 2006. It's 73% above the five-year average. Even during the financial crisis, it wasn't that bad. However, the prior record of 22 wasn't set during the financial crisis. It happened in the first and second quarters of last year when polar vortices and a variety of other issues were blamed. Only 11% or three companies issued positive guidance, tied for worst place with the first quarter 2006 when the housing market was plateauing. Then there's the nagging fact that 10 of these companies have issued negative revenue guidance, with only one company issuing positive revenue guidance. The consumer staples sector was even worse. Of the five companies in the 500 S&P that issued guidance for the fourth quarter, all of them were negative. But there's more to it. FactSet has a chart showing the corporate manipulation of the hype mongers on Wall Street with the goal of bringing down the estimates so that the adjusted pro forma non-GAAP X items earnings per share numbers, this great American fiction, can beat the lowered estimates. The charade makes sense from a corporate perspective in this crazy market that, according to FactSet, quote, has rewarded companies issuing positive earnings per share guidance more than average and punished companies issuing negative earnings per share guidance less than average, unquote. Quarter after quarter, negative guidance rose while positive guidance dropped. And in the fourth quarter, they'd gotten completely out of whack, a quarter when the hoped-for boost provided by lower gasoline prices disappeared in a reality where consumers are being run dry by economic growth that is happening somewhere else, but not in their wallets. Of the 24 consumer discretionary companies in the S&P 500 that have issued negative earnings per share guidance, 13 are in retail, with specialty retail accounting for 8 of them. FactSet calls the missing boost to earnings and revenues surprising. 7 of the 24 consumer discretionary companies that issued negative guidance, quote-unquote, specifically discussed lower oil and gas prices. And they had seen either no positive impact to date or that the positive impact was being offset by other negative factors, end of quote. Ross Stores explained its lower guidance this way, quote, there are so many other factors, some good, like the decline in unemployment rates or the anniversary of cuts in government programs, but some bad factors as well, like the increase in part-time work or the lack of wage growth for low-income workers. So we really don't know to what degree gas prices helped or to what degree they'll help going forward. End of quote. Dollar Tree commented on the potential for reduced trucking costs due to lower diesel prices. Quote, but it has to move quite a bit to have a significant effect on the overall cost because the fuel is just one component of the overall trucking rate that we end up paying. End of quote. Target said they saw, quote, some encouraging signs including lower gas prices, end of quote, but that spending by consumers remained, quote unquote, quite volatile. It blamed the promotional nature of the competitive environment. Macy's also saw some positive factors that they described as lower gas prices, lower unemployment, and healthy financial markets. But then there's, quote, the reality of the recent trend caused in part by customers spending more of their disposable dollars on categories we don't sell, like cars, healthcare, electronics, and home improvement, unquote. Royal Caribbean Cruises blamed the strong dollar whose negative impact on earnings was only, quote-unquote, partially offset by reduced fuel prices. Lower fuel prices just couldn't compensate for the other issues they were facing. 9 mentioned higher costs, vexing inflation that doesn't officially exist. 8 blamed the strong dollar, though it would lower costs. 3 blamed sales, which is a hard thing to admit to. And 3 blamed the old standby, competition, and higher promotional costs. Retail prices of gasoline have fallen by an average of $1.12 a gallon from a year ago, according to the EIA. And this is how it boosts consumer spending and cranks up the economy. Some sectors are making more money, such as airlines, because their costs are going down, not because consumers save so much money that they're flying more. If consumers spend more overall, it will be for other reasons. And those other reasons, as the retailers have pointed out, might crumble in the face of the numerous negatives consumers are still facing. But those would be the lucky ones, not in the oil and gas business, not living and working in the oil patch, where the oil price collapse and financial engineering are coagulating into a toxic mix. So the message for you to take away from all this, ladies and gentlemen, is don't believe what you're going to be told by the damnable mainstream media about how lower prices are peaches and cream for you going forward. It's just not true. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and with that, the halfway point has arrived, so it's time for our promos, and I'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and as always, let's go to the mailbox and start with an email from Miguel Almeida Deca. Dear Mr. Martin, listening to your show religiously for some time now, your show has certainly improved with time. Well, that's good to know, Miguel. Thank you very much. Years ago, I read a very interesting book by a German thinker, Jürgen Habermas, titled Legitimation Crisis. It was written and published in the 50s or 60s. What's interesting about the book is that it borrows the point of view of French structuralist anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss to analyze the functions of power in the West. According to the French structuralists, Western society is built on a grid of mutually reinforcing institutions whose unstated goal is to legitimize the primacy of each institution as they are progressively integrated into a more centralized whole. Call it a kind of super corporate gestalt. The fuel that keeps the machine going is legitimation. And legitimation only works when it is fabricated by the official institutions that form part of official society. Typically, official Western society has been built on the corporate model, always run by morally and spiritually degenerate aristocracies. These societies are constantly at war, always attempting to expand their territories, and view, almost as a robotic reflex, all outsiders as potential terrorists. Unfortunately, this is the real historical legacy of the West. In his autobiography, mannerist Italian artist Benvenuto Cellini observed that the needs of modern society are determined by its insatiable appetite for artifice. Artifice ruled in Renaissance Italy, and it rules today in Europe and its dominions. Western power has rarely, if ever, been guided by an honest search for truth. Instead, the West fabricates artifice, the real lifeblood of the system and the real essence of the official legitimation of its institutions. The only way out of this cultural quagmire, in my opinion, is to adopt values that have for millennia been crushed by the heavy boot of repetitive Western action and thought. And those values arise from the organic and the spiritual, and not from the immoral grandiosity of Western bureaucracies and its self-serving agendas. Unfortunately, Western man derives its identity and character from its identification with the images of Western power and domination. That programming is very ingrained and acts as the real obstacle to the evolution of human society in the West. The real irony of the present moment is revealed in the often repeated accusation from Western media that Islamic fundamentalists want to take their societies back to the Middle Ages. But that is precisely what the West is always doing economically and politically. They project their reactionary agenda onto an alternate screen, much like one would see in a movie theater or in one's private imagination. And that same trick is all that is needed, like dope for a heroin addict, to keep things as they have always been. The same. Without the same, the West dies. Best, Miguel. Well, thank you for that, Miguel. Very interesting and erudite, and requires a lot of thought and reflection. All right, then comes a very nice letter from Sarita, who wrote in saying, "Dear Richard, I'm using my time at home listening to your wake-up call programs and actually taking notes. I want to be able to speak correctly of what you say. Was listening to the one on oil where you are speaking of how it has gone down to $65. Well, Sarita, it's gone a lot lower than that. We're down to $48.99 right now. Anyway, interesting to understand the continuity of one program to the next and seeing how oil has kept losing value. Had been watching the 300-point ups and then downs, and today, as I am writing, am seeing the market is down 202. Also, have heard comments of guests on some of the CNBC shows speaking of how oil is creating havoc, even though individual people are happy not to spend so much on their gasoline. Wonder if they will be asked their opinion again. Seems people who are knowledgeable aren't the preferred speakers. In the couple of hours, you will be speaking on the wake-up call. I am looking forward to spending that hour listening to you and learning. For me, that hour is immensely valuable. What you transmit is a priceless class where I listen deeply and fine-tune so that at the end of the hour, my life is always enriched. For the time and information you are about to give me, I am most grateful. Thank you. Best regards, Sarita." Well, I know I can always rely on Sarita for real, intense, profound support, and she does not fail me this time round. Thank you, Sarita. I very much appreciate it. All right, so now comes the redoubtable Steve Kruger with his contribution to the day's activities. "It's a sobering thought that many of the jobs of the future have not been invented yet, Richard. It's sad to see into the minds of utopian thinkers. The good Professor A. Gardner sees a bright future for humanity and tons of new carrier fields and new jobs popping up all over the place, like crabgrass on a pristine lawn. He does not account for just what people are supposed to do while their old job is sent to Legoland and a new job is being born. Just how does the professor think people will earn money to live? Or does he think that money will have no place in his shining new world? When people have no money, they resort to criminality. So maybe the professor sees a state check for those not working. The unworking masses will now have both money and free time. I feel we would revert to what we humans do best, going forth and multiplying. The professor says our schools would develop creative minds. Is he kidding? A creative mind is exactly what public education seeks to stifle. I do think that artificial intelligence has been given the green light and that we humans are simply not going along for the ride. The 0.01% that have the bulk of the planet's wealth already sees the world as overcrowded. Artificial intelligence is their perfect solution. Artificial intelligence has no human frailty. It does not eat or sleep, does not require 400 channels of TV, no drinks or drugs, no boner pills, nor is it encumbered by any religious belief. I enjoyed the article. You always send out thought-provoking material, and it's good to see into the heads of Washington Post's ideologues. Steve Kruger." Well, thank you, Steve. That's useful and interesting. Well, 92.4 Americans are considered to be not in the labor force officially. This number is incredibly high, and it's a large factor accounting for the drop in the employment participation rate. While many older people are winging it when it comes to retirement, One-third of the private workforce is supporting two-thirds of the population. Part of the reason there are so many people in the not in the labor force category is partly due to the aging of the country, but that only accounts for one portion of the change. A large portion also comes from the unusual jumps in the disability category, a large number going back to high-cost college, and many simply dropping out of the market completely. The rate of increase in each of these categories is growing much faster than the rate of growth in the population, suggesting something else is going on. The unemployment rate on the surface looks to be much healthier than it is because you're removing millions of Americans from being counted. This isn't a political statement, but a simple math issue. You have one-third of the population supporting the other two-thirds. This is the highest percentage that's ever been experienced in America. It should have seemed impossible to see 100 million Americans being part of the not in the labor force category, but the trend is heading there. Back in 2009 alone, there were 82 million people not in the labor force. In the span of 5 years, we've added 10 million. So should the trend continue, we'll hit 100 million by 2020. There are 108 million private sector workers out of 319 in the U.S. population. Many obviously can't work for health reasons or because they're children. But the rise of these 10 million in the last 5 years is coming from other categories that speak to a weak underlying economy. These are people that in any other decade would have been working. Sure, there are job openings, but many simply don't have the skills for these positions. Also, you have a massive number of new jobs coming in the form of low-wage labor. You can see the divergence by looking at the growth of the population versus the growth of those not in the labor force. Some of it has to do with the aging of the country, but that only accounts for one part of it. The number being added to this category has gone up in a straight line, even though we're supposed to be in a dramatic recovery that has created a new record in the stock market. Yet there are fewer people as a percentage of the population working. This is a new record for the current generation. Inflation is also hitting while wages are stagnant. So many Americans are seeing a slow erosion to their buying power. This simply means more deficit spending and more pressure being put on the backs of those working. With millions of Americans using Social Security as their default pension plan, there will be more focus on making sure this is fully funded. Medicare costs are skyrocketing in conjunction with the cost of health care overall. All of these things are interconnected. All of them. And so, unfortunately, the large majority are not benefiting, although oil prices will help somewhat. Yet this is a drop in the bucket when you have 92.4 million Americans flat out absent from the labor force. Well, it's been 66 years since George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984 was published. In it, Orwell depicts a future where the UK, and the whole world really, descends into a totalitarian regime that's in a perpetual state of war, propaganda, and persecution. One of the most disturbing aspects of the story is the omnipresent government surveillance and complete lack of privacy. People live in apartments equipped with two-way telescreens so that they could be watched and listened to at all times. Public spaces are similarly littered with recording devices and microphones so that everyone is kept in check. Undercover agents pose as normal citizens and report any person with subversive tendencies. Children become government spies. Everyone snitches on everyone else. Does this ring a bell with you, ladies and gentlemen? Do you recognize any of this from 1984 in your lives today? Because a lot of these elements are only too familiar. There's a complete lack of privacy online, with governments brazenly snooping on every activity, from tracking people's movements to trolling social media, intercepting and storing emails and instant messages, listening in on voice conversations, etc. Most public spaces are full of CCTV cameras. Financial privacy, of course, doesn't exist anymore. Financial nudity is the norm today. Everyone, from bankers to brokers to payday lenders, is forcibly being drafted into the ranks of unpaid government spies. 1984 takes place fairly and squarely in the UK. It was Orwell's view of what his country would develop into the future. The irony is not lost on us as we regrettably report today that politicians in the House of Commons in the UK are right now debating legislation put forth which would, quote, require teachers in nurseries, elementary schools and other educational institutions to report children between ages 3 to 11 with terrorist inclinations, end of quote. The legislation is part of the Counter-Terrorism and Security Bill that's currently in Parliament in London. It says nurseries should ensure proper training to give the staff, quote, knowledge and confidence to identify and challenge extremist ideas which can be used to legitimize terrorism and are shared by terrorist groups, end of quote. It will become teachers' duty to monitor, track, and report children's words and actions that show signs of sympathy with terrorists or is a risk of potential radicalization. Now this is happening in the UK, but it could easily be anywhere in Western Europe or North America. Not long ago, the West used to stand for something. It was the beacon of freedom, liberty, and human rights, and hope. The West gave people the chance to rise in life. Now, sadly, it's turning into Orwell's dystopian version of itself. Soon, a teacher won't just be someone charged with the education of the children, but rather another unpaid government spy. Life really does imitate art. Back in 1984, when the West was fighting Soviet ideology, could we ever have imagined something so intrusive? And yet, 31 years later, it's actually happening. The West is in a perpetual state of decline, both in terms of economics and freedom. It doesn't happen overnight, until it does. But when you take a long-term view, it's hardly recognizable. In the country where you're living, the same place you remember, is that the same place you remember a decade ago? 30 years ago? This decline is one of the biggest stories of our time. There are no solutions. Only evasive action. Take it. Soon. All right, well, here's some updated economic information for you to enjoy, ladies and gentlemen. The U.S. Census Bureau's report tells us that new orders to U.S. factories fell for a fourth straight month in November, with demand in a key category that signals business investment plans down for a third month. The Commerce Department said Tuesday, factory orders dropped 0.7% in November after a similar 0.7% fall in October. The November weakness came from decreases in demand for primary metals, industrial machinery, and military aircraft. A closely watched category that serves as a proxy for business investment, spending dropped 0.5% in November, making the longest stretch of weakness in this category since 2012. Economists, of course, remain optimistic that the drop in orders is a temporary soft patch and a stronger economy with increased consumer spending will trigger a rebound in demand in 2015. Well, here quickly are the gory details. November aggregate decline was 0.7%. Excluding transportation, new orders decreased 0.6%. Excluding defense, new orders down 0.4%. Durable goods, new orders down 0.9%. Non-durable goods orders down 0.5%. Shipments down 3 of the last 4 months. Durable goods orders down 3 of the last 4 months. October decline 0.7%. Transportation equipment aggregate down 1.3%, with automobiles down 2%. Heavy-duty trucks down 4.4%. Motor vehicle bodies, parts and trailers up 0.5%. Non-defense aircraft and parts down 4.7%. Defense aircraft and parts down 2.3%. Ships and boats up 0.7%. Well, automobile orders being down 2% and heavy-duty trucks down 4.4% are the standouts. Those numbers suggest to me that the auto party's over, or soon will be. I have a few simple questions. Who wants a car? Who needs a car? Who can afford a car? And who doesn't already have a car? Subprime auto loans are a key reason sales were as robust as they have been. Oh well, as always, just asking. Okay, well, while we're on the subject of unemployment, a quick report, or rather a quick word on the unemployment report, which came out earlier today. Not the glossy mush the pundits would have you believe, I'm afraid. So do follow along here if you would. The official line goes like this. Total farm payroll employment rose by 252,000 in December, and the unemployment rate declined to 5.6%, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting today. Job gains occurred in professional and business services, construction, food services and drinking places, healthcare and manufacturing. Oh yes, no doubt about that. Well, if you believe the cooked numbers, that is. But the internals look pretty nasty. Let's start with the ones that are being talked about. Average hourly earnings fell. Not by a lot, and average earnings, hourly earnings remained stable at 34.6, which, by the way, is far more important than the earnings themselves. But this is from the establishment survey and is seasonally adjusted, that is, made up. The household survey tells a different story entirely. The household survey says that the total number of people employed fell by 476,000 last month. This on the back of a minus 270,000 print last month, making this 1 month off from a trend. Three makes a trend, and worsening from the last report. In addition, the number of those who left the labor force increased by 959,000 last month on the back of 506,000 leaving the labor force last month, also 2 months of three, and again worsening. The employment-to-population ratio decreased by 2/10, also being the second month in a row of declines. So the bottom line here is that the decrease in unemployment had exactly nothing to do with improved employment. In fact, actual employment declined for both of the last 2 months, but instead was comprised of people who are unemployed giving up on finding a job. That, of course, is not being reported. All that is being talked about is how strong this report is given the establishment figure. However, the lie factory is running into a fairly serious problem in that full employment, which is commonly regarded as around 5% unemployment rate, should bring significant wage pressures. And that, of course, means upward. That isn't happening. And the reason it's not is quite simple. The actual number of people employed is falling, not rising. And as a result, there is no reason for employers to pay more. Well, the carnage is definitely getting worse. I've already talked about the closing of oil investment firms and hedge funds. Now it's spreading to the middle class. U.S. Steel just announced the closing of at least two plants that make steel for the oil industry. This will affect thousands of middle-class people who have good-paying jobs, not just the plant workers who get laid off, but all the people who provide services and materials to those plants will be affected. One miner working supports seven people outside the mine in full-time jobs. I'm sure the oil industry has similar numbers. The oil industry is laying off people in the thousands. Contracts are being terminated. Exploration has come to a standstill. The ripple effect could result in millions of jobs lost. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is just the tip of the iceberg we're running into with America's titanic economy. All right, well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for another show. It is the weekend, and it is time for me to wish you a very happy one, and take care of yourselves. I will be back on Monday, as usual. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.